So if someone asked you, who is Jesus? And why does that matter to me? What would you say? Better yet, where would you even begin? And maybe some of you would start with a very theological confession. Maybe something you learned as a child. Jesus is the Son of God, or Jesus Christ is Lord. Maybe you'd start talking about the cross and the resurrection. For some of you, that may feel like it comes across a bit too strong. Maybe we should start with the historical Jesus. You might try and describe him as a sage, or a hero, a martyr, maybe even a holy fool. Was he a miracle worker or just a beloved rabbi? Was he a prophet? Was he something more? These questions about who Jesus is, about why that matters, they're the questions that the disciples are wrestling with throughout the Gospel of Mark. In the weeks leading up to our reading for today, the disciples have struggled to understand just who Jesus is. And they can't quite put their finger on it. Mark tells the story back in chapter 8 of Jesus feeding a crowd of 4,000 people with 7 loaves of bread and a few fish. And this story, it's reminiscent of a story that we find in the book of Exodus, when God, through the prophet Moses, provides food for the people when they're in the wilderness. And the miracle seemed to be a clear connection, but the disciples are still wondering, is Jesus God in this story, or is he Moses? Is he the deity or the prophet, the tool of God? They debate amongst themselves. A few days later, Jesus is walking and there's a blind man and he heals him. But this seems impossible. Jesus is a small country rabbi from the middle of nowhere. Maybe Jesus didn't actually do this. Right? Maybe the guy wasn't blind after all. He was nearsighted or developing cataracts. Right? Surely Jesus didn't actually do this. Now, Peter, Jesus' chief of staff, he seems the most confident in who Jesus is. And so he says boldly, I think you are the Messiah, the long-awaited leader that God would use to free the Jewish people from Roman oppression. Now, this isn't a statement that Jesus is divine, just that Jesus is a God-ordained freedom fighter. And it's with these questions, and even probably internal debates amongst the disciples swirling around them, that they walk up to the mountaintop, Transfiguration. Suddenly, without warning, Jesus' appearance is transformed. He's robed in white. His appearance is radiant. He's surrounded by Elijah and Moses, the two greatest prophets in the Jewish tradition. And the disciples are surprised to the point that Mark tells us they don't even know what to say. Peter is just giving word vomit when he starts talking about those three tents. He doesn't know what to do with himself. So here we go, Jesus. Here's something. They're seemingly ordinary and maybe at best extraordinarily human teacher has been transformed into a radiant image that appears, by all accounts, divine to them. It feels as though the curtain has been drawn away from Jesus' appearance and we are seeing the God behind them. Jesus here alone is transfigured, transformed into a form that shines with the very essence of God's glory. This is what we miss in our English translation here. Jesus isn't just shining as if somebody has put a spotlight on him. He's shining in only the way that we see God's glory shine in the Bible. This is a pivotal moment. It's the Transfiguration. It's this surprising moment when what we expect to see, what we expect to happen, is revealed to be something else entirely. Think about it. Jesus' three closest disciples, they went up to the mountaintop expecting to have a leadership retreat. And instead, they encounter the presence of God. Jesus is not just a great man or a destined leader in this moment. He is something else entirely, and the disciples are going to spend the rest of the Gospel of Mark trying to figure out just how to articulate what has happened and how their understanding of Jesus has fundamentally shifted. In this moment, the ordinary becomes the holy. The first Christians, the mothers and fathers of the church, they believed that this story related to what happened when people gathered together in a community of faith. This transformation that occurred, it was what happened in the church. What happened when God began to work among them? Something ordinary became something holy. So as I'm thinking about these voices from church history, I stumbled upon a story of an interesting ministry from a church called West End Collegiate Church in Manhattan. And their ministry is called A Taste of Heaven. And in the early 1980s, West End decided to start a Tuesday night soup kitchen, essentially, so they could provide meals for the large homeless population on their side of the city. The ministry was that came for these folks, it's people without a fixed address. Many of the people who come to the Tuesday night dinner, they carry with them bags that represent their entire worldly possessions. They come, some dealing with social anxiety, others with mental illness, some with physical ailments, some of them with all three. And eventually, the church decided to add a pre-supper Bible study to this dinner, which is par for the course for a church-run soup kitchen. But when Reverend Jess Cast arrived in 2011 as the new associate minister at West End, the dinner and Bible study began to change dramatically. Now, at the time, the soup kitchen had moved from the fellowship hall to the sanctuary because their fellowship hall was under renovations. Right? And one night, all of the men and women, they've gathered, they're eating, and in their sanctuary, their stained glass is actually Tiffany stained glass. It's Jesus looking down, right? And so the reverend has this image of everyone eating and Jesus is looking down upon them, right? And she thinks to herself, I wonder where these folks go to church on Sunday. Where do they worship? Here we are in this sanctuary. So she starts asking. And turns out most of them did not go to church. And for a variety of reasons. Here were a couple she listed that stuck out to me. I don't go to church because I wouldn't feel welcomed. What would I do with all these bags? Said another. I'm not sure I know what to do or how to interact. Right? These comments could be said by a lot of people. And they're both heartbreaking and revealing. And they filled Cass with what I can best describe as holy discontent. She soon realized this soup kitchen ministry needed to focus on much more than just meeting people's physical needs. There was a deep spiritual hunger to be met as well. And so she began to reimagine what their Tuesday night gathering would look like if it focused on belonging, not just feeding. And so working with the people who came and attended the Bible study evolved into this innovative and interactive worship service with its own liturgy and practices that involve candle lighting and prayer and sermon. And the dinner became more like a celebratory banquet. Every Tuesday night is a party. There are members of the church who are actually world-class musicians and said that they would come and play music in the background while people ate. Turns out they love it a lot more because at the dinners that they play at that are $5,000 a plate, no one pays attention to the beautiful music being played. And at the end, at most, one person gives a very polite golf clap, right? At A Taste of Heaven, they're playing for what feels like a sold-out crowd. An energy of joy and of happiness. If you ask someone who's unfamiliar with West End's Tuesday night service, they might tell you that it's just a very creative soup kitchen ministry. But ask the men and women who attend each week, those who've been a part of this community and it's helped them leave behind lifestyles of addiction or supported them through finding housing and losing it and getting it again. Talk to those members of what has become a congregation and they'll tell you it's not a soup kitchen, it's a taste of heaven. A place where they are welcomed, where they're loved, where they belong, where they can worship authentically, without worrying about other people staring at them, where they can eat and pray. Attending the weekly service is a moment where an ordinary space becomes sacred, where you discover suddenly and surprisingly you are standing on holy ground. This is what those church mothers and fathers believed happened when we gather together. Because in the Gospels, the transfiguration is only a preview of the fullness of God's love revealed in the resurrection and the power and glory that is to come in the Gospels. It's given to the church at Pentecost. It's released out into the world. Our reading for today is a glimpse of the glory of God made real in the life and ministry of the people of God. Because we're not called just to read this and see Jesus for who he truly is. That's only one step. The next is to live lives in such a way that reflect this transfiguration, that reflect reflect that something greater is happening here. There's a lot of talk swirling around in our society these days about the decline of the church. You read the most provocative headlines and you think that I will be out of work in the next 2 months, right? I'll be leading a museum study on tour of religion in America or something like that. We have these generations of the nuns. Have you heard of them? Not Catholic nuns, N-O-N-E, those kind of nuns, right? The spiritual but not religious, those people who have just given up on God entirely, I've read. But this hasn't been my experience when I talk to friends, when I meet people. I don't find a generation that is wholesale giving up on God. I actually find people who very much believe in God, who have a deep hunger for a meaningful spirituality, but what they've given up on is they don't believe that the church or organized religion is the place where you can find it. Recent research would also back this up. What we have is a generation of people asking, who is Jesus and what is the church and why does that matter to me? Because when they look at the church, all they see is an ordinary association of people that have a weekly, hour-long program, sometimes inspirational. If that's all you have, well, I can join a book club. I have a meaningful soccer league. If all you have is spiritual practices, I can go to yoga. I can read a book, right? But is there something much more than that happening here? I would argue that the church at its best is not some association of people who have a TED Talk once a week. We are called to offer a glimpse, a taste of what God is up to in the world. We model what the world could and should be. We are a community where the power and love of God is at work in our midst, and we're doing our best every day to try to live into that. We're not a place for membership. Go to a country club for that. No, we're a place for belonging. We're not a place to find things to do. Your work and family give you enough of that. This is a place to discover meaning and purpose. A place where you can make a difference in the world with other people, where you might even contribute to changing it. The real challenge for us today is to consider how are we showing that we are a transformed, a transfigured community to a world that desperately wants to see that, that wants to experience it. May have forgotten that that's possible entirely. At the Anabaptist, we've long felt that one of the best ways that we can show we're a different kind of community is to engage with our world around us. That when we put God's love into action, we demonstrate that it's transformed us. It's not just something we think about or talk about. It has shaped our values and priorities. And it's taken shapes of all different kinds over the years, but always stretched us and challenged us to follow Jesus in new ways. Recently, over the past few months, we've been thinking about this, particularly how it relates to a community at the Vienna Park Apartments, which is about a mile down the road. It's at the intersection of Cedar Lane and Park, for those of you who know Vienna well. The Vienna Park apartments are home to hundreds of families that live in about 300 units in that complex. Most of the residents are immigrant families. They come from primarily Latin America, but many also come from other regions in Africa and in Asia. They're working families. Some work as custodial staff in the local elementary schools. Other clean houses in Vienna. Others work at different jobs in Tyson's Corner. Their children are in classes with your children here in Vienna, or your grandchildren. Due to the high cost of living, I said there are 300 apartments there. It's not 300 families living there. You have multiple families living in the same apartment. Imagine living in a one-bedroom apartment and your family's in the master bedroom, another family's in the living room, and maybe you've strung up a curtain so there's two families there. There's three entire families living in one small apartment. My wife and I almost drove ourselves crazy our first year of marriage, and it was just the two of us in an apartment like that. Many can't afford to own or maintain a car, so they rely on public transportation to get to work, to the grocery store, to the library, to doctor's appointments. And the Vienna Park apartments was a great location because they used to have a bus stop right out front. And this bus stop ran down Park, and it would get you to Maple Avenue, to all the shops and businesses, grocery stores and things, and then on to Tyson's so you could get to work. But due to budget cuts in the county over the summer, the 2T bus was eliminated, even though it had plenty of ridership. And the decision has put people on hard times. People like Alicia, who immigrated from Honduras to Vienna in 2003 and has lived in the apartments ever since. Alicia has two young daughters, both at Cunningham Park Elementary School. One's a first grader, and the other is in third grade. For her girls, Vienna is home. It's the only community they've ever known. With this bus line being cut, they don't know if they can stay. Alicia's already had to leave her job in Tyson's. She started trying to clean, she works cleaning houses in Vienna. And while she can get to work now, she misses the money she was making in Tyson's, the variety of opportunities for work that she had when she had access to public transit. She also has trouble now getting to the grocery store. Her grocery store, I don't know what your grocery store if you live in Vienna is. Hers was the Giant on Maple Avenue. But now, to get there, she can't just take a bus to go. So she's got to walk at least 40 minutes one way. It's about a 2-mile walk to the grocery store. And when she gets to the grocery store, she's got to decide what to buy because all of the groceries she gets, she's going to have to carry home with her. Can you imagine trying to negotiate two little girls, a 2-mile walk, and two handfuls of groceries just to make dinner? Alicia's not alone. Other residents tell stories of 5-hour-long trips to the doctor's office, getting stranded when the bus line got cut after a late shift at work and no way of getting home at 11:30 at night, taking kids to the library to read, or going to English classes has become an epic endeavor. It's been members of this church, some part of our BBC Voice Mission Action Team, that have felt called to respond to this need, to work to restore meaningful bus service to these families. And it's not because we're a nonprofit that specializes in public transportation in Northern Virginia. It's because we believe, as a church, we're called to get to know our neighbors. And when we meet them and we see a need, our task is to respond in loving action. This is how we reveal that the love of God is at work in the world. This is how we model what Jesus did. Jesus was out one day, if you remember the story from Mark. He saw a crowd. He saw people that were hungry, and so he fed them. The next day, he was going around. He saw a blind man, and he healed them. It turns out, long before we get to the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus has already been giving glimpses of what God is up to in the world. It looks like the hungry getting food, the blind getting sight, those lost finding belonging and community, those seeming far off, feeling away from the love of God, being welcomed in with open arms. The Transfiguration is just the most dramatic display of this, in case you weren't paying attention to the story. Transfiguration is not just a good story. It's something we can experience in our own lives. We can experience personal transformation. We can live lives that seem full and joyful when we let our schedules, our priorities be shaped and reshaped by what God is up to in the world. Turns out, in helping others, we find our own needs met. In giving away our own time and energy, we find renewed passion and strength. It's the great paradox of the gospel. It's in giving that we receive. So I hope this spring you'll consider how you might participate in the Transfigured community. Maybe you'll help in our work with families in the apartments or with local students in our schools. Maybe you'll find other opportunities for discipleship and mission. Pay attention to those invitations of God to follow deeper. It's in these moments that you'll discover life anew. And so this week, may you be a person whose every conversation, whose interaction with others, whose way of being in the world shines with the light that God is up to something new, that God's love is real, that it changes things, and that you are trying as best and as honestly as you can to be a part of that in the world. Don't worry about being perfect. If that was a requirement for our trying to do good in the world, Jesus would never have had followers. Take one step. We offer enough opportunities here, I'm sure you'll find one. And may you experience transformation in your life. And may you be a part of the transforming of the world. Through the love of God, amen.